Hello, and welcome to the Morality of Everyday Things.
I'm Ant.
And I'm Jake.
We're longtime friends, business partners. Also, we do this podcast together. Morality of Everyday Things, for anyone who is new, welcome, is a podcast about everyday morality, where we ask questions like, is it okay to be a billionaire? Should billionaires exist?
Are you a bad person if you work at Facebook?
And in today's episode, are luxury goods immoral? Or maybe we'll find a catchier title, like, is owning a Rolex, does that make you a bad person? In light of the spate of robberies recently.
Before we get into today's episode, we just wanted to do a little bit of podcast shout outs. You're welcome to skip ahead a little bit, but basically just
15 seconds.
Thank you to everyone who has left reviews. We really appreciate that.
We've had the best review ever recently. It was a 3 out of 5 on Apple Podcasts. It was with reference to our meat eating episode, and it said something to the effect of a surprisingly balanced argument considering they're carnists. Which, you know, actually, to be fair, if someone could say that, I'm relatively pleased with that. If someone could come from a position of staunchly disagreeing us from the outset and saying, you know what, actually, I don't agree with them, or I don't agree with their overall outcomes, but it was an interesting discussion.
It was balanced, at least.
Yeah.
That's what we try and do. Try and inject some nuance into the debate.
Exactly. Another one, for those who don't realize, we don't plug it that much, but we do have a Patreon, and we thought it was fitting to actually give some shout outs. First of all, shout out to Georgia Kerr, longtime fan of the show. Hi, Georgia, if you're listening.
Thank you, Georgia.
Thank you. Signing up as a member is as low as $1 a month. It helps us cover the production costs and eventually growing the production value of the actual podcast. And it does also give you access to messaging us directly. I mean, you can still reach out to us on social media and stuff, but we will obviously give special attention to those people who reach out to us on Patreon itself.
Mm. So thank you for everyone who's supported us so far. All reviews help. Motivates us, and it keeps the show ranking and
True.
Helps other people to find it.
And actually, one other thing. If you do enjoy the show, and maybe you've had this slight inclination in the past, don't forget that actually, especially for a show like ours, where we are conscientiously, having tried it once or twice, with the exception of maybe the occasional crossover, really not looking to bring on guests, the number one growth method is people just sharing it with their friends. And I don't want to like prompt that. You know, that should happen organically. If you like it, share it with people. If you think something's interesting, share it with people. But just a little nudge that if you've been on the edge of doing that, on the cusp of doing that, and then been like, nah. it does really help us build the show and add production value.
Cool.
And be able to make episodes more frequently. Also, actually, a little note on that. It's been about a month since we last released. Sorry about that. We had it scheduled earlier. We had some urgent business stuff that came up, and we ended up wanting to refilm the episode rather than the version we'd originally done.
Thank you guys for putting up with that. That's all the housekeeping stuff over. And now on to today's show.
Yes. So, Jake, today's question is, are luxury goods immoral? I just want to put a little signpost and say, this is really getting back to basics for us, because this is, you know, some of the questions sometimes we'll be like, what are things that interest us? And it'll be the other way around, like, oh, we, you know, what's something we want to discuss in an episode? And this is one of those questions that actually is why we made the podcast. It's the other way, where we were just having discussions at lunch, and it kind of prompted us like, ooh, we should read more about this, think more about this, and actually create an episode on it. Just because we were having lunch and I made the throwaway comment that I think jewelry is stupid and wasteful and, you know, downright immoral. And then we were kind of talking about like, okay, but what about if it's an accessory? What if it's a good value item of jewelry? What if it was just really expensive to make? And I was arguing that jewelry, its primary function rather than accessorizing, was to communicate wealth. So this is all stuff that we'll cover.
It is. But the point there is that, yeah, this is kind of original form podcast material. This came about organically, and we're like, hey, do you know what? We've had an interesting discussion about this literally over the lunch table, as the show description says. Let's turn this into an episode. So structurally, there's going to be two parts to this episode. And the way we like to split it is, part one, we're going to really dig into the definitions and some of the frameworks and what makes a luxury good a luxury good.
Yep.
What makes something immoral? How do we bring those together? Part two, we're going to dig into the moral arguments.
Yep.
And we're going to look at, like, for example, Peter Singer. He'll be a big theme.
Spoke about them before, but this is really the crux of luxury good, morality, immorality, Singer, and effectively an opportunity cost argument.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the flip side, some sort of libertarian perspective or capitalist libertarian perspective.
I've earned the money. I can do what I want with
it. Yeah, basically. And then also, actually, I really want to examine something around, I believe it's Susan Wolfe.
It is Susan Wolfe.
And her argument about moral saints. And basically, is the kind of over-moralization of everything, does it actually sap a little bit from a real consideration of what, like, a enjoyable human experience actually is? Like,
exactly.
Should everything be a moral decision?
Cool.
So let's start with definitions. I think this one is really interesting because, when we dug into it and thought about it a bit, you know, a lot of this is unique, our own thought, as opposed to like, well, this person said this. But, you know, you kind of realize that there's a few different ways of looking at these luxury good ideas. And I think we came to an understanding that kind of breaks luxury goods into two really key different sets of luxury goods. And we'll explain that in a second. But let's start with a really high level definition.
We'll work backwards, or not backwards, forwards. We'll work from the beginning. And let's look at the
speaking of the beginning. Etymology, yes.
Let's look at the etymology. So the word luxury originates from the Latin word luxuria, which means exuberance, excess, or abundance.
Hmm.
And then if you sort of travel onwards into like sort of the modern dictionary definition, that kind of continues. So a luxury, I think this is the Webster's dictionary, says a luxury is something adding to pleasure or comfort, but not absolutely necessary.
Mm.
Or it's an indulgence in something that provides pleasure, satisfaction, or ease. And then the examples they give is one of life's luxuries, or he had the luxury of rejecting a handful of job offers.
Right. Interesting. So I think the thing that they're touching on there is a concept of not necessary.
Yeah,
right?
That seems to be a key thing that comes out, right?
Yep,
it's the opposite of a necessity.
Yeah. This is one of the things. Where'd you draw that line? We'll come to that. Another one that's worth considering is an economic definition.
Mm.
Now, I think the funny thing about this is that it's a bit like defining a sickness by its symptoms rather than explaining how the bacteria or virus makes you sick, right? So when you hear this economic definition, it's like, okay, that's a good heuristic for identifying when something is a luxury good, but it doesn't seem to properly capture what makes something a luxury
good. It's almost like a diagnostic, right?
Yes, exactly. So in economics, a luxury good or upmarket good is a good for which demand increases more than what is proportional as income rises, so that expenditures on the good become a greater proportion of overall spending. This is in contrast to necessity goods, where demand increases proportionally less than income.
And just to break that down really clearly, what that's saying is, as you get richer, you'll spend a greater percentage of your money on luxury goods. As you get poorer, you spend a greater percentage of your money on necessity goods. And that's kind of intuitive.
It makes sense, right? Like, let's say your necessities cost $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
And if your disposable income is $20,000,
you're going to spend all your money on
100% will be on necessities, right? And then as you start to earn more than $20,000, every incremental bit, you know, with the exception of savings or whatever, every incremental bit that you spend will be on luxury goods.
Yeah,
you
might you treat yourself to.
Exactly. You might start to upgrade some of your necessities to more luxury goods.
Or you mean like nicer necessities?
Yeah, so like there's
this
a little bit of a gray area,
right? Yeah.
So if I start like, if I upgrade from like the cheapest bread available at whatever your supermarket is to like sourdough, like is the marginal difference an amount that's going to luxury goods?
Is sourdough a luxury?
Yeah, but I mean, like, you wouldn't argue that bread is, right? You'd be like, yeah, well, you need to eat basic carbs, right? But you get my point there. And I think that describes it well for people. So it's a good way to look at something and be like, is this thing a luxury good? Well, do you... Basically, you can actually frame the question as, do you consume proportionally less of it as you have less income, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is yes, then clearly you didn't need it. So it's not necessity good. That's you can. I actually think sometimes looking at the other way around is more helpful. So it captures the economic essence. But like I said, it's lacking in that social context. It doesn't really explain, with the exception of basically saying it's not a quote necessity good, which is defined as X, it doesn't really touch on like what it means for something to be necessary.
That's because colloquially, when we use the word luxury in the way we would sort of, before we even looked at the economic definitions, when we were first arguing about this, there's a kind of like social understanding of what it means to be a luxury. Like it's one of those things you know it when you see it. So there's a sense that a luxury is something, obviously one, it's not necessary, but two, it feels excessive, or there's like an element of status that comes into it.
Yes.
And this kind of, I mean, this links nicely to what we were saying in the etymology point, right? It's like exuberance, excess, abundance.
Yeah.
Something superfluous to what's needed.
Yes. Okay. And this is where we start to think about where you draw that line, right? So we can think of the example of a car, right? And this is a bit like the bread example, right? On the one hand, do you need a car to survive? Literally no, right? On the other hand, can you live a reasonable modern life without a car? You could also argue no. And then
it depends where you live, right?
Well, yeah, it depends a little bit on where you live. So when you say where you live, then you're starting to say that necessity is defined by social context.
Yep.
Which actually I think is fair.
I think so too. It's somewhat relative.
Yep. And then also, even within that, okay, let's say that, you know, it's reasonable to say you need a car, right? Mm-hmm. Even then, you know, you have the extremes, like the cheapest car you can possibly buy, but runs reliably, like isn't a net expected. I'm not saying you need to fall into the trap of buying a lemon, which is an economic term for like a bad car, like where you might actually spend more fixing it. But, you know, you could buy the cheapest car you reasonably could afford, but it might not be very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it doesn't have some of the extras like seatbelts. No, I'm kidding. Air conditioning.
Or like, heated seats.
Yeah, exactly. Stuff like that. But then when you take it to the extreme, like a Ferrari, like, okay, I need to get around, so I quote unquote need a car. That doesn't mean I can then call a Ferrari a necessary good.
Yeah.
And so there's a line somewhere in the middle where it's like, I can
around the mark of a nice Audi.
Yes, exactly. There's a line somewhere where you're like, okay, yes, this is a necessary good, and some of these features are like fair enough to include in that concept of necessary, but then at some point it becomes excessive and unnecessary. And this actually, this discussion question is kind of what brought us to thinking about, we were having a similar conversation, like I said, over the dinner table, lunch table, about jewelry. And this is where we kind of realized that, you know, maybe when we're talking about luxuries and things that aren't strictly necessary, maybe even then you can break that down a little bit further. Because I think it's interesting how when you're talking about necessity, you suddenly realize I need to talk about what is and isn't necessary. Because, you know, if you think about COVID, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, basically everything shut down that wasn't quote unquote necessary to survival. And then you very quickly realize, you know what, actually, maybe the medical definition of necessary isn't quite the same as like necessary for a life worth living, right?
This is a thing.
When all entertainment and the ability to see other people shut down.
Yeah, I was going to say this is something we'll definitely come back to. But most listeners will probably be familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
Do you remember this?
I do, yeah.
So this is a pyramid.
Maslow and I had a really good time coming up with that, actually. A couple beers and a European, I assume he's Central European or something. Carry on.
Yeah, I can't remember when he was around.
I do. We did. We made this pyramid.
What, back with the Egyptians? he's a psychologist who came up with this pyramid where he's saying, at the very base of the pyramid, the sort of fundamental human needs are physiological. These are things you literally need to survive, like
food,
oxygen,
shelter,
warmth, etc. Water.
Wait, more warmth metaphorically?
We'll
come to it.
Not
metaphorically. At the base level, it's literally like, what will stop your body from ceasing to function?
In fact, I'm just going to Google it so I get it right. But then as you go up the levels, you've got things like safety. So, you know, this is sort of shelter. This is like, you know, financial security even kind of comes in on this level. Mm-hmm. And then you've got belonging. And so that's like, you know, you form like meaningful relationships.
Yeah.
Fulfilling social needs, exactly.
Strictly, you know, if you had zero friends, would your body survive?
Mm.
Yes. Actually, some evidence suggests not as long, but yes. Interesting from that Harvard study where they track people for decades.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, the number one indicator of your lifespan is the strength of your social networks.
Yeah.
Not, you know, how healthy you are, whether you smoke or not, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they correlate as well, but the most important one was how socially healthy are you.
It makes sense. And actually, this is a bit of a tangent, but it reminds me, I read something recently about like drinking and the health effects of alcohol, and they were actually saying one of the things that makes studies a little bit tricky is exactly this, that when you drink, it's a great way of forming social bonds, and this can act to counteract the sort of harmful effects of overdrinking, is the fact that you build these memories to the extent that you remember
you have all your drinking buddies.
But yeah, you do, it does help to, like, you know, this sort of mutual vulnerability helps to form social bonds that actually, exactly like you say, are a really good predictor of like long-term health. Because
you know what, sorry, a tangent to your tangent, you use the word mutual vulnerability, right? I have no problem with people who choose to be sober. I actually really respect it. Some ways I think, like, man, like, if I could do that, I would be
sleep so well.
I'd sleep so well. I'd be a productivity machine. But I happen to enjoy the socializing. The calculus doesn't quite add up for me. Instead, I just try to conscientiously not overdo it. Although I can't say that I always succeed at that. But then the reason I just jumped in is because it reminds me of an analogy. I always say, like, I have no problem with people who are sober. And some people are better than this at others. But sometimes when people come to drinking things and they're sober, if it's the odd person and they're still, you know, loose and fun, it's not a big deal. But it can feel a little bit like the person who turns up to an orgy fully clothed. It's like, we're all here being
analogy.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Well, you know, whatever. The guy who turns up to the nudist beach fully clothed. Like, everyone else is a little bit vulnerable, and you're still there seeing everyone being vulnerable, but you're not being vulnerable yourself.
I see what you mean.
And it just kind of creates a little bit, that's part of the reason I think people are uncomfortable around people who are sober in contexts where other people are not sober, right?
Mm.
It's not that, like, it's not that they're judging your decision or whatever necessarily. I think it's more that kind of like, ooh, as the term you use, we're supposed to be mutually vulnerable here. And now I'm just vulnerable.
I think that's one of the things that does genuinely strengthen social bonds.
Yeah. That was a big detour.
Coming back to the pyramid, upper level from love and belonging, you have esteem. Mm-hmm. And that, I suppose, is just like, I don't know, your skills, your abilities, things that build your confidence.
Feeling good in yourself.
Yeah. And then the very top is self-actualization.
Ooh, how amorphous. does he have a definition for that?
Is it
finding a sense of meaning?
I think so. Trying to zoom in on this thing. It's desire to become the most that one can be.
Mm-hmm.
This just reminds me of when we went surfing in Cornwall, and there was that room with all the showers. Mm. I don't know if that's a...
Where is this going?
Well, I don't know if that's a story that's going to translate necessarily. But there was... we were all in our wetsuits. We came back in from surfing and they're like, we were freezing cold. And then there were these hot showers. And then you figured out that you could get like four showers to point at you all at once.
Oh, that was a good moment. Yeah.
And you were like, I have fully self-actualized.
I thought that there was a deep point to that.
There really was. Just,
I have fully self-actualized.
It was just like a meme moment.
Yeah. I was like, you know, in the Power Rangers, when they all go in their little machines and it forms one giant machine. This is my final form.
Anyway, sorry.
Very dramatic.
But so, Maslow's hierarchy was...
Talks to necessity and where you draw that line of like what
exactly
counts as necessary.
And
right?
COVID, like you said before, is a really interesting example of this because...
Entertainment, not necessary. But yeah, then, you'd never say, and this is kind of the crux of this point, like where do you draw that line for what is and isn't a luxury? Because in a sense, all entertainment is a luxury.
Yeah.
Right? Like when push comes to shove, you're going to stop paying to go to the movies and go out over... eating.
Yeah,
or shelter.
Course.
Or, you know, similarly, like you're going to give up your sourdough bread and buy Tesco's basics.
Mm. It's why you work from the base of the pyramid upwards. But you only have to look at how well Netflix and other streaming services did over COVID to realize that actually there is something quite important about this, like even entertainment, you know.
Yeah, it does feel a genuine need. It's just not needed for literal physical
survival.
It's just
not as high priority as physiological needs.
Now, the reason that we say this is because... when we're talking about this in the context of jewelry, like we were saying, we were talking over a lunch table. Basically, someone was saying to the effect of like, well, you know, one, what happens when, you know, what if I think the decorative impact of clothing is important to me? It's good to my self-esteem.
Yeah, it's an esteem level, right?
Yeah.
That's the level it's operating at.
In the same way that, you know, having social connections might not be necessary to survival, but it's important to me. It makes me feel good. And then the other thing they said was, what if this is like highly skilled stuff that, you know, the reason it's expensive is because it's hard to make and has high value, not just frivolous, it's communicating wealth to people, right? Like what if the reason my Rolex is $10,000 is because it's an amazing instrument, not because there's a 90% margin there? And it was this discussion that kind of made us think like, you know what, actually, maybe there's two ways to think about luxury goods. And both of them meet this description where like, they aren't necessarily strictly necessities on reasonably any definition that you want to give for like what counts as necessary, what do we need? But maybe some of them are expensive by virtue of the cost of production, and the benefits that they give you are often kind of more in the like mental realm.
So more
it makes you feel good, right? Or self-actualization. Because you have to remember as well, humans communicate symbolically, right? Like this is an argument that I have all the time where people are like, this really drives me crazy. When people are like, I want to dress this way. I want to dye my hair blue. And that's just what I want to do. Like I'm not like listening to whatever, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no. The fact that you think that's what you want to do because you don't care about what other people think is actually you caring about what other people think because you're trying to communicate that you don't care what other people think. Like the conception of hair as blue as like a counterculture symbol is exactly why you're doing it. It's not like you wouldn't necessarily naturally in your, like, I don't know, if you imagine humans running around in the wild, like you would be like, you know what I need?
I need some blue hair.
No, it's so you have to remember as well, humans are in a communicate in a symbolic nature.
Your point
so it's
there.
That self-esteem, self-actualization kind of level of like, I am doing these things to some extent communicate who I am. And that's not just to other people. Often that's also to myself, right? So I had a really interesting discussion the other day with someone because I'd mentioned this discussion and they said, and it was also discussed over the lunch table. What if my jewelry is heirloom, right?
As in passed down. Inherited.
Passed down. What if I don't even wear it? What if I just know that I have it, right? And that, to me, is valuable. So, for example, when I was christened, it's very typical in Orthodox countries that you're christened and your godparents get you a gold chain with a cross, right? And I had this for a very long time and I just kept it safe. Like, I just kept it in a safe, literally kept it safe in a safe.
keep it secret.
Keep it safe. Because to me, that was an important way of basically like cherishing the feeling that gave me and the sense of identity it imparted to me. Like, this is part of my culture, whatever my culture is.
So that's on a like belonging level as well.
Yeah,
but clearly
it didn't actually communicate to anyone because I wasn't wearing it, right? So it kind of counteracted my idea of jewelry in that sense. Like this is now just a cherished belonging beyond what the thing is worth, in the same way that a childhood teddy bear can be, right? it actually communicates to me something about who I am and my past. So we kind of understood suddenly like there's this idea, first of all, there are luxury goods that communicate, that impart value in this way. And secondly, like some of them so in the context of jewelry we're talking about, that there was a little detour there, but back to my point, you know, sometimes if you think about jewelry and communicating to other people and stuff, like jewelry can serve a genuine function, accessorizing, right? And what happens when you start to get jewelry that's reasonably priced considering how much
expensive
it costs to make.
It is to make, yeah.
And is just an adornment. And, you know, I think even the strictest person can agree, like, you don't have to be totally, is it aesthetic? Ascetic?
I don't know how you say it. Ascetic is how I've always read it. It's probably not pronounced that way. But you mean living a minimalist life?
Yes, exactly. Like, yeah. You don't suddenly argue that, like, everyone needs to do that. Well, this is what we're going to come to in the moral sense argument, right? Mm-hmm. You know, not everyone needs to be Gandhi in, like, a shoe, like, eschew or a shoe?
A shoe.
We're bringing too many difficult words here. I've only ever read them.
Yes,
Yeah, that one. You don't need to suddenly, like, consciously push away all of these. One, ability to communicate who you are and your past and your symbolic self. Mm-hmm. And two, enjoy some of these things, right? And understand that, like, necessity is more than literally surviving in order to have these things. What about jewelry from Accessorize, right?
That
like
stuff
really
isn't cheap jewelry.
Yeah, like, that's really cheap. It accessorizes, literally, names in it. You know, I guess what's the US equivalent? Hot Topic? Like, cheap. Not
you're
fate.
Asking the wrong person.
Yeah, cheap jewelry that serves the purpose, accessorizes, but isn't made with rare metals and clearly doesn't communicate wealth. Mm. Does that fit into the same thing?
Is that necessarily a luxury?
So anyway, sorry, this is a long way of saying there's probably two types of luxuries. One is this, like, maybe it's expensive by virtue of cost of production, but maybe it's good value, right?
So you're saying something luxury is just something expensive?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's this economic definition where, like, you consume more of it, the more disposable income you have.
Sure.
You consume less of it, the less you have, right? Disproportionately. So clearly it's not needed. So it's not needed. It is generally expensive, but good value, right? And the middle one, like I said, generally expensive. Like, not all luxuries are necessarily even expensive. It's just, you know, buying coffee out is a luxury.
Yeah.
Right? Unless you're a caffeine addict. Although even then, you'd find cheaper ways to meet that need. But then we come to the second one, and this is really the one where we start to think with our moral hats a little more on, right? Because some goods really do solely display wealth. And they have one of the features of that is that they have a huge margin, which means that they're not good value. They're not expensive. You're paying for something other than the physical product there, right?
You're paying for the brand.
Yes, and often it's brand that you are paying for, yes.
If I recall when we first had this argument, I feel like this is at least what was... getting your goat was
well,
a sense
and this
of a luxury
is, this is,
where, like, it's a brand, like, I'm just picking on Rolex and Gucci just because they're obvious sort of luxury brands, but they've created something, an artifact, whatever it is that you
a cultural symbol.
A cultural symbol, exactly. And the expense and the margin is excessive. There's a socially understood thing that you're wearing this because you're wealthy. Like, a Rolex is a symbol
of wealth. It is to communicate wealth.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And I mean, that's really, it's funny because when we were talking about jewelry, I realized that we reach a more nuanced point nowadays. But really, that's what I was hitting at, right? I mean, there are a few good examples in history. First, I want to just hit on a couple bits of terminology around that, right? So first of all, we talked about luxury goods. But then we have this second category we were talking about where it's like, you know, they have really high margin, the function is to display wealth. Normally, you would describe these in economic terms as items of conspicuous consumption.
That's a lovely expression.
Yes.
I always really
enjoy
that.
And many of these fit into a very rare product category. And that product category is called Veblen goods.
Cool.
Named after the economist something Veblen.
Thornsten Veblen, I think, or something like that.
Oh, Norwegian or something? Sounds like anyway, not the point. Veblen, you're getting credit. Calm down. We don't know your first name.
I'll give you the definitions of those. So, conspicuous consumption is a term in economics that describes and explains the practice by consumers of using goods of a higher quality or in greater quantity than might be considered necessary in practical terms.
Yep.
So what that's saying is basically you're buying stuff to signal.
Yes.
Like, you don't need as many of this thing as you've bought, or you don't need it to be as nice. It's a Ferrari versus buying a regular car, or it's a luxury apartment versus a normal flat.
Or, I mean, I think a really interesting thing that we said there is of a higher quality or a greater quantity than might be considered necessary. Think about watches, right? I can tell the time on my phone.
Yeah.
I can buy a Casio for like £5. Even the fancy looking watches, you could buy a fake, right?
You had a friend who did
that. Well, this is a funny story. Yeah, I remember a friend was saying, you know, they like to collect expensive watches. Or it was a friend's dad or something like, friend of a friend's dad, someone like that. Anyway, what they said was, and recently in London, there's been a spate of like expensive watch theft. And they were saying basically, oh yeah, what they do is they buy this expensive watch. And then for every expensive watch they buy a fake that's exactly the same. And then they wear the fake out. And if it's stolen, no big deal. They have the... but to them, it doesn't feel like it's a fake because they know, it's, no. I credit for this. I have the real one. I'm just not wearing it, right? Which is it's on the one hand, kind of brilliant. On the other hand, it really makes you think, at some point, it's like, well, then why do you have the real one?
Yeah.
Right? Like, what's the point? Like, the fake is good enough to wear out. And suddenly, at some point, it's like, you are just buying this to tell yourself that you have it. and to make yourself comfortable wearing the fake. And the intention of wearing the fake is to communicate to other people, hey, I am a big deal. And I remember actually, I had a friend, and I remember they once, it was someone I briefly dated.
A friend.
Friend in quotation marks. This was quite a long time ago, nearly a year ago. I remember at one point they were like, oh, you have passed my test. And I was like, one, I don't like people who test people, but okay. Two, what is the test?
What score did I get?
Yeah. How much out of 100? And they were like, you saw my watch, but you didn't treat me any differently.
What was the watch?
I hadn't actually noticed the watch. I didn't care. But actually, if anything, I think I saw it at one point and I was like, a bit showy. They had like a Rolex, right?
Whoa.
But they explained to me, I have this Rolex. It's a fake Rolex. Mm-hmm. And they worked in a client-facing role. And they were like, I have noticed people genuinely treat me differently upon realizing I have this, right? Mm-hmm. And so they use it as a test of character. Like, are you the kind of person who cares whether I have this object? Right. Mm-hmm. Which kind of speaks to, okay, maybe we're undervaluing the fact that like these goods have impacts on our lives and on other people and do communicate something.
People care about fashion.
Whereas I'm the kind of person who sees that stuff and I'm like I said, I think if I recall, I saw it and was like, like really? like just a bit much. Sorry, that was a little diatribe on the watch thing.
Yeah.
But yes, sorry, it's higher quality. Coming back to the definition of conspicuous consumption. It's using goods of a higher quality or in greater quantity. Fancy watches, it's not necessary to tell time, doesn't have any extra utility, right? Mm-hmm. A Gucci handbag. If anything, a lot of these are practically not very good handbags. Like, you know, get a backpack, get a satchel. But I mean, even then, to the extent that you value that look and feel, if you think about these Gucci handbags, this is a very common practice. Mm. The fact that they're literally made in like sweatshops and factories in China and other countries like that, right? And once they have the material and the pattern, a lot of them will make extras, right? And then sell them as fakes. They're not real because they're not sold at the branded shops and stuff. But it is literally the same product
material.
Made in the same place. And it might be a tenth of the price or whatever, right?
That's mad, isn't it?
And then you kind of, you know, you think about my story about the guy with the watch and the fake watches. And at some point it's like, well, then what's the point in the real one? What I'm going to sound like such a cliche philosophy podcast guy, but like, what even is the real one suddenly, right? Like, oh, the fact that you've paid too much for it in the branded shop, it's the same thing. It's literally the same thing. Not all fakes are literally the same thing, but, you know, lots of them are of sufficient quality that the difference is imperceptible, hence people have them.
Fascinating.
Anyway, so that was a conspicuous consumption definition. Jake, the next one, which is really interesting.
A Veblen good.
And again, if you buy these, it feels mad when you hear this definition. Go on, sir.
Yeah. So a Veblen good is a type of luxury good for which the demand increases as the price increases, in apparent but not actual contradiction of the law of demand. So just to break that down, the law of demand basically says as the price falls, you buy more of it. This is a wild case where the price rises and actually people want to buy more of it. And the result is an upward sloping demand curve. That definition will be familiar to any students of economics. But if you're not, again, it's what I just said. Hmm. Price falls, you should buy more of it. That's normally how markets work.
Now, these ones, I think this is basically what we're talking about. And this really captures that concept of conspicuous consumption, right? It almost like empirically proves that people are buying this thing for what I would say is the wrong reason. The discussion whether this is the wrong reason. And we've kind of talked about the importance of symbolism and communication. Whatever
hinges on the importance. Hinges self-expression, hinges on stuff like that, right?
So if this is basically saying there are some goods where when the price goes up, the demand for that good goes up.
And why might that be?
Yeah.
The key thing here, I think, is kind of what you're saying. It's about making it a status symbol.
Yeah. It being more expensive makes it more of a status symbol.
Exactly. Just to round off the end of that definition, the higher prices of Veblen goods make them desirable as a status symbol in the practices of conspicuous consumption and conspicuous leisure. Mm. A product may be a Veblen good because it is a positional good, something few others can own. And that's just saying like when something's rare or scarce, that you'll necessarily want more of it. And that's like saying, it's kind of crazy, but it's like, imagine something goes on sale and the price increases, like Gucci bring out an even more expensive handbag and suddenly people are like, oh man, that's the one I need to get. Like
I mean, here's another example, right? If you think about the most expensive watches in the world, I would actually hazard a guess that the most expensive watch in the world sells more units than the 10th most expensive watch in the world.
Mm-hmm. Because it's got a symbol.
Yes, the most expensive watch in the world communicates more effectively that it is really, really bloody expensive. Sometimes there's also, I think on the extreme other end, this can also happen a little bit. Sometimes when something's too cheap, you know, rather than it being like, oh, this is better value than before, suddenly you get a human bias where it's like, what is this communicating about the value?
Yeah.
Right?
It's too cheap. It's suspicious.
It's too cheap. It's suspicious. And this is the other thing. I think like to people's credit, sometimes when they see really expensive stuff, sometimes they don't understand that the function is status. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they might be, well, if it's super expensive, it must be really good, right?
Yeah, you assume there's a correlation with quality.
Yes, exactly, which may not exist. You know, we've given these two ideas of luxury goods. For ease of, you know, description later, we've described one set that are good value, but not necessary, and another set that are bad value, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. These conspicuous goods, whose function is status. And I think, to give a really high level statement on the outset, all luxuries to some extent have moral trade-offs. We'll come to that. But really, I think the first ones are kind of a gray area, and it depends a little bit. Your social mm-hmm. context, your personal means, your personal views on how moral one should be, etc. The second ones are the ones where I start to feel like, okay, there isn't much space for arguing that these are anything other than wasteful. Because, I mean, this is my personal moral position, but it feels like effectively wasting money to let people know you can waste money feels like a bad use of money.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about this. But do you remember the app, the I'm Rich app?
I do remember.
Back when it was the iTunes store, or the App Store was just first out, and you could buy it for $999, which was the max price an app could be set at. And I mean, I never got it, obviously. I think I remember being told that when you opened up this app, all it did was flash, I'm rich.
Yeah. It's the perfect example, right? The sole purpose, it's one of those things where, like, it was so post-ironic, it stopped being ironic.
Yeah.
Like, it's the kind of thing someone would waste money on to be like, haha, how silly is this thing? But it actually perfectly captured exactly the point it was making fun of.
Exactly. And the amazing thing is people actually downloaded it. I don't know how many, but...
I mean, it was expensive and it cost nothing to make, effectively. Yeah. So it doesn't matter. It's still a good margin for
those. Those app developers did really well.
Yeah. But yeah, I wanted to give a quick thought experiment to kind of put this stuff in context, right? And let's put ourselves in a context where there is no market. There is no economy. The desert island, right? So if I lived on a desert island, you could still enjoy luxuries, right? There wouldn't be a market for buying them, mm-hmm. but there might be certain things that you would only consider doing for yourself if you have excess time or the ability to exert excess effort above just basic survival. Say you've made your little shelter, you've got fairly reliable access to food and water and stuff.
Cool.
And then you start to be in that position where it's like, I need to sometimes treat myself. I need things to look forward to. I need things to hope for.
Some way of expressing yourself.
Yes.
So you've caught enough fish. You've got water from the stream.
Yes.
You've got your coconuts.
So maybe you could still, you could still enjoy luxuries. Maybe sometimes you catch the harder fish that, you know, is a more unusual and interesting taste. Maybe sometimes you swim out and try and capture lobster.
Whoa.
Right? Whoa.
Do you think you'd value lobster the same way? What if there's loads of lobsters?
Okay, maybe you're sick of lobster. But you get my point.
Lobster's a funny example. Yeah. Obviously lobsters are a sort of status rich food.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's a function of maybe their scarcity, or maybe it's just something we've socially built up as like...
I think it's a little bit of both. I think they used to feed it. Didn't they used to feed it to prisoners in the Caribbean or something?
Really?
I can't remember. Or maybe that's like one of those apocryphal stories, but I think that's true. But you're right. It's market dynamics, right? In a lot of places, because it's hard to get.
Caviar is a funny example of that, because I'm sure, like you've said, I think there are places where, you know, fish roe is common. It's like cheap. So
yeah, I mean, particularly sturgeon are common.
Yeah,
there.
Exactly. Yeah. But the fact that we've built caviar up as like a real symbolic sort of luxury food is funny. That's kind of just a function of the way markets have evolved.
Exactly.
Anyway, sorry to come back to your point. So let's say lobsters are rare. Yeah. And catching one is effort.
But to you, it's a special treat. You enjoy it. It communicates nothing to anyone else. It's just something that is, you know, more quote unquote expensive, not in cash terms, but in effort terms. But you occasionally do it to treat yourself to an unusual, interesting extra pleasure to your normal life. It, you know, it spices things up, right? That seems to fit into that first category of good value luxuries. So the point is, even in a space where there is no market, you could still treat yourself to stuff. You could still, it's this idea of treating yourself
to something,
you know, that benefits you. You know, you wouldn't necessarily perilously climb up a mountain in search of shiny stones to just put around your neck when you're the only person who lives on that desert island.
Mm.
And that's kind of the point I'm trying to make. Like, would you enjoy this in a vacuum? The only problem is, and this is then to flip it around, human existence isn't in a vacuum. We're social creatures.
We exist in a social context.
We exist in a social context. And again, to kind of contradict my own point, and this is part of the reason it's so hard, and it's part of the reason these goods do exist, you know, what happens when you derive a lot of pleasure from letting people know that you are high status and wealthy?
Well, right?
What happens when that makes you feel good and does that self-actualization?
This could segue quite nicely. Why don't we develop your desert island example into there's a small tribe on the desert island, or just tribes in general?
Yeah.
And then suddenly you start to use fashion as a means of self-expression, not necessarily self-expression in a sort of actualization sense, but like
status.
You communicate your status in the tribe.
Yeah.
And then that links to your, I think it's your Native Indian example you're going to give.
Well, so this is Native Americans in, I believe, Washington State.
There
was the practice they had that was outlawed. Part of like electing a new leader was that they would literally amass the largest pile of stuff possible and burn it. Mm. Because it was a statement of like, this is how powerful and wealthy I am. I can get all this stuff together and waste it, right? Mm. And I think it was outlawed by American government because it became a bit ridiculous. And then flip it around as well. Not flip it around, but similarly, you know, in the example you're giving, Pacific Island communities often throwing large feasts in kind of, you know, local political settings is a method of communicating high status, high value. Mm. And similarly, it's one of the communities where, similar to a lot of Western communities, actually, some centuries ago, being overweight was really a status symbol as well. yeah, because it communicated having the means to amass that weight.
It's like the right? Venus de Milo, right? That's the sort of original symbol of beauty was like actually being well fed.
Exactly.
It's funny because we've always likened the Native American example to the purchasing of Google AdWords in modern startup culture.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a perfect analogy. It depends if your ads run profitably or not. But assuming you lose money on the first purchase with those ads, it is a bit of a competition as to who can sort of burn the most money at the altar of Google.
Yeah. It has some.
Don't know if that's
some,
familiar to
it's
all
not,
users.
It's, yeah, not familiar. Also, not a perfect analogy, but a funny anecdote for sure.
Yeah.
And it's funny, like, actually, when you think about these symbols of signaling, a couple other ones that I find interesting or annoying, suits, right? I think it's so funny that suits are a symbol of conformity, when in reality, suits originally were an intentional
symbol of wealth.
Symbol of wealth, right? Mm. The reason you wore a suit is because literally other people couldn't afford to wear them, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas now, in mass market, you can buy them for a very reasonable price at M&S or whatever, or you know, Target, or maybe even Walmart. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't live in America. Sorry. I'm not sorry. What's wrong with me? I'm such a British apologist. But you understand my point, that suits used to be actually like a filtering mechanism, the same way expensive jewelry is. Mm. And in the same way that we now, you know, you can go to your cheap stuff and buy fake jewelry to accessorize, mm-hmm, you can now buy these suits and they flip from a symbol of exclusionism or elitism
to
a symbol of conformity and not even state. I mean, there's still an extent to like, oh, do you work in a suit, you know, blue collar, white collar? Do you, mm-hmm, wear a suit to work or not? Yeah, largely it's kind of dissipated in that format. And then also royal purple. Jake, tell us about royal purple.
Do you know what? I actually can't remember the royal purple example.
It's very simple. Same thing. Purple was a royal color because it was expensive and difficult to make.
Right. So it was dye itself was actually quite...
So it was naturally an elitist symbol because it was like, well, you literally couldn't wear purple otherwise. Mm. But then to kind of add to that, I remember there's... I can't remember which Roman emperor, but one of them banned highest court. I can't remember what level they drew the line at, but like, if you weren't at least this level, you can't wear purple, mm-hmm, to really turn it into a status symbol.
Wow. The last example we have in the notes, it's just gold toilets. I don't know if this is just a joke.
I think it's
are there gold plated toilets? Is this like a palace
Trump.
Of Versailles?
Have you not seen? Of course. Yeah.
Right.
And it's also Trump. Like, yeah, of course. I think that's just a funny metaphor, right?
Yeah. Like, it's so excessive.
So excessive. And if anything, it starts to I think when you take these ridiculous examples, for most people, it starts to tip into the like, you have entered irony here. Like, this is so excessive, it actually helps us realize how ridiculous luxury goods can be. Sorry, so there's a little bit of back and forth diatribe there, you know, detours. I'm sorry, guys, we're taking detours. Deal with it. That's how we do. I think the point is overall that like luxury goods can exist outside of even the context of markets, like we gave that desert island example. Mm-hmm. And the question is, when are these luxury goods starting to be detrimental? And I guess this is my personal fundamental view. Even the ones that are quote unquote bad value or conspicuous spending, they serve a human purpose, right? Like it can still make people feel good. There are people who feel good having their Gucci bag and their Louis Vuitton shoes, right? Mm-hmm. My question is, and this is the kind of moral imposition I'm making on people, at what point should we be reconsidering the content of our character and saying, you know what, actually, like maybe it's a better way of addressing this need and feeling I have is to, you know, actually address it rather than placate it with expensive things, right? My need, my feeling and desire for status, to the extent that one has that that's driven by having expensive things to communicate your wealth, is it more effective to continue buying these expensive things, even if you have the wealth? Or should you be addressing that struggle head on? Should you be somehow working out how you can be the kind of person who resolves that need that you have inside yourself or absolves yourself of that need somehow, rather than the person who actually meets that need with excessive consumption? Considering, as we will in the next part, sorry, this is going to be part two, you know, when you're buying something, a major moral consideration is think about the other stuff you could be doing with that money.
Mm-hmm. The opportunity cost.
Yeah.
Are you sort of suggesting that people are the victim of advertising?
I think advertising adds to it.
Mm.
But I don't think that they are the victim of it, no. I mean, like, I think that these desires and needs existed before advertising. Like, you know, medieval kings wore crowns long before the like media complex kind of worked out that they could convince people they need to buy things. Mm-hmm. Another interesting story, De Beers rings.
I was going to say, yeah, we haven't talked about De Beers and diamonds and stuff in general.
I mean, this diamonds are a funny one. This comes back to the jewelry thing, right? Value of diamonds entirely inflated. Like, there is one company who basically had like a monopoly on the market, and through a combination of restricting supply and smart marketing, you know, hey, you need to buy an engagement ring. Most people don't realize the idea of an engagement ring
was invented by De Beers.
Was invented by the people selling diamonds within the last century.
Who also invented the rule that an engagement ring had to be a certain proportion of like X months of salary, right?
And which is obviously ridiculous. I mean, ingenious on their part, but I feel like any reasonable partner, again, this speaks to my personal values, but any reasonable partner should be like, I would rather a much cheaper ring and that money be used on us doing experiences together or building a life together.
It's amazing that you say that, but now that's like, it's such a social norm that it's, I don't know.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I've bought into the social norm. Like, if I were to propose to someone, I would get them an engagement ring.
Yeah, because you'd look
really
cheap.
Exactly. It's all about, at some point, you have to keep up with the Joneses.
Exactly. You recognize that you live in a social context as well.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah,
interesting. But yeah, the De Beers point is cool. It sort of speaks to advertising and the effect of that. But how else would you suggest to address these? You didn't phrase it exactly like this. Let's say you're calling it like an insecurity. How else would you address this insecurity? Is it fair to call it an insecurity?
I think advising people in the sort of therapy that they should see is a little beyond the scope of this podcast.
But you see it as a social problem to buy expensive things for the purpose of communicating wealth.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I see it as a social problem. I see it as a problem of waste. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, when what you're paying for is by majority margin, that means that the money is just flowing to someone who's making profits. And empirically, most of these people with the profits basically sit on it. They don't redistribute it in an effective way. We'll dig in this a lot deeper, but you know, say I have £10,000 for something that's worth £1,000. That's £9,000 of excess that I've just given to someone.
For the brand,
given to someone who doesn't need it. Right? Versus, you know, I could have had a product that is functionally the same, minus the brand, and have given that $9,000 to some worthy cause. If I get rid of that need for conveying status, I am in the exact same position, and the world is $9,000 better.
It's interesting that you've narrowed down on margin as one of the key sort of factors in your definition, though, because let's say the same 1,000 bag to produce costs 2,000 retail value. Does it shift from being a good value luxury in your two definitions? From like it was a bad value, does it shift to becoming a good value depending on the price it's retailed for?
I want to clarify that it's a heuristic, right? Because I think we've seen before in some of our own work, right, that like percentage margin is misleading depending on the price of the thing, right?
Yeah.
If you sell something for £5 and you keep a 50% margin, it might be that you just can't run the business, you know? Because another way of saying that is rather than saying, oh, you make a 50% margin, it's I only make £2 per thing I sell or £2.50 per thing I sell.
Yeah.
So how many things do I need to sell?
And to be fair, when you're not selling very many bags, if you're making 1,000 per bag, there's probably... All right, and that's why they retail so high, right? It's because to actually...
maybe a mixture.
It depends. You're right. Because obviously, so like diamonds do make excessive profits, for example, but like you don't sell... I don't know. There's a balance of like quantity and
I get you.
Value.
That is true. Like I don't want to get into the business economics of it because you're right. Like sometimes high margin is justified. If I make an extremely specialized good with a small market, right? Like maybe I need to take a really high margin because, you know, I can't sell that many units and the people who I am selling to really need it and have a really high elasticity to their demand, i.e. are willing to pay a high price for it. So yeah, it's a heuristic.
Yeah,
right?
But I don't think your problem is necessarily with the margin anyway. I think your problem is with communication, the sort of like the way that people use the
why.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the reason, if I'm putting words into your mouth here, but I think the reason you don't like it is because you think that it's distasteful to spend money trying to communicate wealth when you very clearly could have used that wealth for alternative purposes.
Yes, yeah. And to be fair, I guess it's really just speaking to my personal values, which I think you in this regard roughly share. I don't know if you feel as strong as I do about stuff like jewelry and things like that, but like, yeah, it just, it like the analogy I gave of the person with the fake Rolex earlier, the story of that person. To me, ironically, before they explained that it was a fake and, you know, they just see how people react to it, you know, when I saw that this person had that, it had the opposite to the intended effect. Mm. I didn't think, wow, this person's rich. I thought, wow, this person is distasteful.
Yeah, I don't think you're uncommon in having that opinion. I think it's one of those things where it sort of communicates both, doesn't it?
Mm.
It communicates both wealth, and then depending on your personal view, you either admire that or you're like, yeah.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, yeah. I mean, actually, if you think about it, increasingly the zeitgeist of the ultra wealthy is to not act ridiculously wealthy because it's not the Middle Ages. I mean, if anything, they make a concerted effort to not seem wealthy. That's why you get these ridiculously expensive white t-shirts and stuff nowadays. The ultimate status symbol is to not act rich and let it slowly be uncovered. So yeah, ostentatious displays of wealth to me, you know, more often, again, this is, I guess everything comes back to my personal feeling and views. Everyone's moral stuff comes back to like, what do you intuitively feel at some level? You know, it just feels like, why do you need to say this? And could you not remedy this some other way? Okay.
Interesting. I think we've probably, yeah, that's not a bad place to wrap up. I think we've, between us, I think we've got a good sense of what we mean when we're talking about luxury goods.
And although it's still fuzzy.
It is still fuzzy. I the most interesting sort of fuzzy area is cars are a good example of this. Let's say you call cars a necessity. You've got your basic car, which you need to get around. You've got your Ferrari at the other end, which we can all agree is very luxury. And then you've got those cars in between, which are like, they're just nice versions of a basic car or like dumbed down version of a Ferrari. And somewhere, I presume it's a line drawing exercise of like, okay, this is tipped from being necessary into luxury. But it's actually a little bit hard to pinpoint
that. And there's factors like your social context that matter, right? I think, I guess, again, this is kind of more looking at symptoms than, you know, saying why or how. But one way would just be to see how the consumption of that good changes with average household income, right? But yeah, anyway, guys, that's kind of an outline of the definition of, you know, what's luxury. And it was a little bit of an exploration of our personal opinions of like how we morally feel about these things. The next one is going to be looking at the perspectives of some more typical philosophers in the field and basically discussing the moral opportunity costs, but then also a discussion of the fact that being human is more than being moral. So looking at that moral saints argument by Susan Wolf.
Yeah. Is this necessarily a moral question? Or to what extent should it be? Guys, see you in part two.